From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Congressman Stephen Lynch looks back on 9/11 and some unanswered questions, like why the FBI didn't immediately investigate the possible connection between the hijackers and Saudi Arabia.
A major attack killing thousands of Americans, and the FBI puts their feet up? That's not incompetence. That's willful ignorance right there.
Also today,
the single most important transportation innovation of the last decade is unquestionably the smartphone.
Well, starting this month, for $2, you can ride an Uber carpool anywhere in Boston. What impact could that have on the MBTA? Plus,
ooh, Lordy, trouble so hard.
Moby on the transformational power of music.
Like, it just seemed like this utterly baffling alchemical magic.
God, don't nobody know my trouble was gone.
That's next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll begin today with a conversation with Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch. A little over a month ago, Congress declassified a long-awaited section of the 2002 investigation into the 9/11 attacks. For more than a decade, Congress had refused to make public the so-called 28 pages, a special section of the report that examined the Saudi government's possible role in the attacks. Representative Lynch led the effort to declassify those 28 pages. Now, the redacted documents do not reach any conclusion about Saudi involvement in the 9/11 attacks, but they do provide other details, such as FBI information that Abu Zubaydah, a senior al-Qaeda operative, possessed the phone number of a corporation that managed, quote, the affairs of the Colorado residents of Saudi Prince Bandar. The 28 pages also stress that much of the information has not been verified. Well, we are, of course, approaching the 15th anniversary of the attacks of September 11th. And when we spoke with Congressman Lynch earlier today, I began by asking him about a 2014 statement he made to the New Yorker magazine. Back then, he said he believed the 28 pages contained, quote, stunning clarity about the Saudi government and 9/11. Lynch pointed to the section of the document devoted to a Saudi national named Omar al-Bayoumi, a suspected Saudi intelligence agent who had contact with two of the hijackers, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midhar.
These two individuals were supported by Saudi citizens who had very strong connections to the Saudi government, the Saudi royal family. They were supported financially. They were assisted in getting housing. I think Bayoumi actually helped them get to survey flight schools so that they could get lessons on flying commercial airliners. So two individuals didn't know the language at all, were basically handled during this whole time. And by these agents were the whole process of the 9/11 attacks were facilitated.
Yeah, so Bayoumi was believed to have been a Saudi spy, right, or at least connected with the Saudi
intelligence
Intelligence agent. I was reading that in fact he was actually stripped of his diplomatic privileges in 2002.
Right, he tried to come back into the country.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, the 9/11 Commission later on said that the more damning allegations, they couldn't find any substantial evidence to support them.
Well, the 9/11 investigation only had a brief amount of time. If you read the 28 pages, just read the first five sentences. Basically says that there were connections between the Saudi government and the hijackers, and that they are unable in the limited time they had to definitively say, you know, what those connections were. I think what is really damning about this is that in spite of the fact that there were 19 hijackers and, you know, all these connections between the Saudi government and the hijackers, the FBI never engaged in an investigation of the Saudi connection. It was only when the Congress came together and appointed the special inquiry. That was a year later. And what did they say? What did the FBI say when the 9/11 Commission contacted them for evidence, they said, we knew you would do that. We knew you would do that. So they basically let the trail end right there. A major attack killing thousands of Americans, and the FBI puts their feet up and waits for Congress a year later to then begin? I mean, that just kills me. It kills me. That's not incompetence. That's willful ignorance right there.
You know, I was reading an article written by Richard Clark just very recently. Of course, mm-hmm. Richard Clark was the national coordinator for counterterrorism, both under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. I mean, he was the one who wrote the infamous Bin Laden memo, right?
Right.
And he says he wonders if part of the reason why the FBI had never been informed prior to 9/11 of the presence of these two men in Southern California. Because he says that the CIA knew they were here in the United States and that the CIA had actually been asking the Emirates, Malaysia, and Thai intelligence services to keep track of these guys before they first came to the United States. And yet they never told the FBI that these two al-Qaeda operatives were in the U.S. And he's wondering why that is and how we might ever find the answer to that question.
Right. Now, obviously, there was a serious lack of information sharing. That goes on to this day that, you know, it's gotten a lot better since 9/11. But I think the events of 9/11 certainly throw a lot of that lack of communication into contrast.
Yeah.
You know, it's just it's deplorable, but it happened. And, I don't know how we undo the lack of communication back then. All we can do is try to do better going forward.
Now, there are aspects of the report which are also still not public. For example, interviews with President George W. Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and even, I guess, the 9/11 commission interviewed President Bill Clinton as well. Would you like to see those portions be made public?
Absolutely. And there are other documents that were requested. ATM transfers of cash from Saudi Arabia to the United States, trying to get those documents from the Saudi government. We've been unsuccessful up to this point and have been for a number of years. So, you know, I'd like all of that information to be made public. And hopefully there are some enterprising journalists that are out there that are digging for this information.
What would you like to see happen if more of these aspects of the reports get made public? I mean, what do you want the consequences to be?
Well, I think the root of this is really the extremist madrasas all over the world. I was in Mumbai recently, and out there on the dump, one of the biggest dumps. It's like a mountain. You know, there's an extremist madrasa, you know, bringing in poor, you know, Indian kids, pumping out that vitriolic and extreme Wahhabi doctrine into those young people. That's happening all over the globe, and Saudi Arabia is the source of that. I just think that the more the story is told of what went on then and what continues to go on today, I think we'll will open a lot of people's eyes, I think, and maybe force the Saudi government to recognize what they're doing.
So, Congressman Lynch, I think this is an extraordinarily important point, actually, because the United States has long officially sanctioned Iran as a state sponsor of terrorism.
Right.
There's material evidence that that has happened.
Right.
I can see how, if some of the allegations in those 28 pages are substantiated, then there would be material evidence of Saudi support of the 9/11 hijackers. But do we really even need that material evidence for the United States to tell Saudi Arabia, we're going to put sanctions on you, we're going to change our diplomatic relationship, we're going to do something because you are supporting ideological forces around the world that are in opposition or not in the national security of the United States?
Yeah, I agree with you. There's enough information out there now to allow us to move in that direction.
Why does it matter to you so much that these 15 years later, I mean, it's been 15 years, right?
Right.
mean, why are you still pushing to get this information out there?
I don't know. Maybe it's just I was elected on September 11th. That was the day of my Democratic primary here in Massachusetts. So I went to Washington immediately after that, and obviously we had a lot of victims of 9/11 that were from our area. Mm-hmm. You meet with those families, and they're still looking for answers. Some of them are part of a lawsuit against the Saudi government and would like to have justice done.
Yeah. Can you tell me what one of the toughest moments you had in the process to get these 28 pages released and what happened?
A lot of it was frustrating rather than just painful. But I remember back in, I think, 2012, they made you make an appointment to read the 28 pages, and you had to go down the basement of the Capitol where the old SCIF was. You had to sit across from intelligence staffers or agency people, and they would watch you as you read the 28 pages. You weren't allowed a pen. You weren't allowed any electronics, and you weren't allowed to speak about it. But I remember after reading the 28 pages, and clearly there were indications that there was greater complicity than was being publicly acknowledged. At the end of it, I said, you know, I just want you to be clear. I'm going to try to make these pages public. I think the American public deserves to have this information, and I think the surviving families deserve to have that information. So that sort of was a challenge to them, and then everything that happened afterwards, they were saying that, you know, these notes were just so sensitive that it would disclose methods and sources and things like that. Then when we got them declassified, they switched in the same breath. And they said, well, there weren't methods and sources that need to be protected. There's just nothing there. There's nothing there. That this is all stuff that was out there before. These were all preliminary assessments, and there's nothing really there.
But so, you'd seen them.
Yeah, right.
So what was your reaction?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just we have to continue to really make sure that the government is doing what we want them to do. And there are so many areas of secrecy, and some of our systems are so opaque that they invite corruption and invite, misguided adventures. The bigger and more complex government becomes, it becomes more difficult to really keep a rein on some of our government agencies like the FBI, like the CIA. There are a lot of great people there, but, in a very real sense, there's also a huge need for us to make sure that they operate, at least in the theater of transparency, with members of Congress and members of the Intelligence Committee, so we know exactly what the heck they're doing.
You're making an observation that many people share, and it makes me wonder what you think. You know, is there a lesson to be drawn with how investigators and intelligence agencies and the government as a whole handled, you know, the classification and then declassification of these 28 pages that we ought to be actively applying to, you know, our current fight against terrorism?
While there is certainly an area where government has to operate in a classified environment, I don't doubt that, but they've got to be honest with someone. And really, they kept a lot of Congress in the dark about this, about what was going on, about their operations. They've become so compartmentalized in the CIA and I think in the FBI that at times they see Congress as the enemy, as opposed to Congress representing the people. And I think that's an unhealthy trend in government today.
You know, this zeal for secrecy isn't any particular to any one party, because I think if I'm remembering correctly, the Obama administration has made more documents than classified than just about anyone.
I understand that, yeah.
Congressman Lynch, before we let you go, this has been absolutely fascinating, and thank you so much for talking to us about this, especially as, you know, we are coming towards the 15th anniversary of 9/11. But can we talk about a couple other Massachusetts issues
while I've got you here?
Mostly because there are several really interesting ballot questions on the ballot this November here. And I'm wondering, first of all, I just want to ask you quickly about charter schools, because there seems to be quite a significant divide amongst Massachusetts Democrats about whether or not they want to lift the cap on charter schools and how they might vote on question two. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm actually a co-founder of a charter school, so I believe in them. A lot of people were moving out of my district once their kids became school age because they could not find a decent school that they had confidence in. I joined with Brett Pizer and Susan Fortin to create the Boston Collegiate Charter School. I'm proud to say it's one of the top public schools, period, in the state.
You did this back in 97, right?
Right. Yeah. So I'm very much pro-charter school, no question about it. I don't necessarily think they're the be-all and end-all, but I certainly am very, very supportive of them, and I support expanding the cap. For a long time, we had dysfunctional traditional public schools that could just continue to operate that way and would have a new class of students come every year, regardless of whether they were functioning or not. And so it just it condemned a lot of young people to substandard education, unfortunately.
Okay, so let me ask you a different side of the story then, because you have long been a very passionate supporter of labor and unions.
Oh, yeah, union president.
Yeah, absolutely. You were telling us just before we started that you've paid up your dues through November.
Yeah.
But I was just reading that just last week, the National Labor Relations Board, for the purposes of labor negotiations, have determined that they will look at charter schools as private corporations because of the fact that, many charter schools do not employ unionized teachers. Does that give you any pause for concern?
I haven't read the decision. So, and as a labor lawyer, I wouldn't want to just talk off the cuff that. So I probably have an uninformed opinion on that, and that's not good. So I'd rather read the NLRB decision and try to decipher what their input was.
Okay, so we'll talk to you about it after you get a chance
to
read it.
Yeah, I'm happy to speak about it.
It's sort of an interesting wrinkle in this very complicated story about surrounding question two. Let's move to the question that could legalize marijuana in Massachusetts. Your take on that?
Yeah, I also founded a facility for adolescent drug rehab. It's the Cushing House. So I'm very much involved in the recovery community. I had problems with alcohol myself in my early years. And I've not met a young person yet that didn't start with marijuana. Now we're going to put these drugs on the street legally and push them out there. I just don't think that flooding the streets with drugs, another drug, is good for society, is good for our country, is good for our young people. How could pumping more and more and more drugs out into the street, how is that a good thing? How is that a good thing?
Well, another frequent and impassioned argument from people who want legalization, as they say, we're imprisoning too many people for marijuana possession.
If you
legalize it, then we wouldn't be doing that if it were legal.
I don't know how many people now are being imprisoned. It had to be for bulk, transfers, because people smoking dope are not getting arrested. If you talk to Commissioner Evans or any major city in Massachusetts, we're not arresting people.
I mean, possession has been decriminalized in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
That's true.
So I think it's a move in the wrong direction. I know I'm in the minority on that. I just have to go with what I know. And, I just think that it's having more and more drugs on the street is not a good thing.
Well, finally, Congressman, we've rounded the corner around Labor Day, and now in terms of the presidential election, it's a mad dash to the finish.
It is.
There's a new CNN poll out that shows Donald Trump actually leading Hillary Clinton by 1 point.
Dear God.
Among likely voters.
Yeah.
I remember that when President Obama was on Martha's Vineyard this summer at a Democratic fundraiser, he warned against Democrats getting complacent.
Yeah.
And do you worry that that might happen? Because it seems as the race is tightening.
Yeah, I worry. I think there's, especially for us in Massachusetts, there's a real sense of complacency. I've talked with Mayor Walsh. I think we're going to try to go to Wisconsin and Iowa to talk to some of the labor folks out there to impress upon them the difference between what a Donald Trump administration would be for working families versus what Hillary Clinton would do.
Do you think that Hillary Clinton could be doing a better job of speaking to working families and talking maybe more passionately and directly about exactly what her administration would do in support of them?
Yeah, I suppose you can always do better. It's been tough to break through with the campaign that Donald Trump is running is really one of, vitriol and push-button issues, the immigration issue, build the wall, things like that. So that's where the energy has gone. I don't think maybe with the debates, we will be able to drill down and actually have an adult conversation about the direction of each candidate and what they would do. I think that would in that context, in that environment where you can actually have a decent exchange of ideas, I think Hillary's superior experience and intellect will come through.
Well, Congressman Stephen Lynch, thank you so much for coming in and thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Meghna. Good to be with you.
And Congressman Lynch is the ranking Democrat on the House Subcommittee on National Security. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Starting this month, you can take a new flat-rate Uber carpool trip. Just $2 a ride to almost anywhere in Medford, Somerville, Cambridge, Chelsea, Revere, Boston, Brookline, and Quincy. Now, that price point puts Uber squarely in competition with the MBTA. In fact, ride-hailing companies in general have been quietly edging into the transit business for a while now. Bloomberg notes that since last year, both Uber and Lyft have crafted agreements with San Francisco, Atlanta, Philadelphia, and others, mostly for so-called first-last-mile programs meant to shuttle commuters to and from bus or train stations. But in smaller towns, they've gone even further, and we'll talk with the city manager of one of those towns in a moment. But this got us thinking. How far can ride-hailing companies go in support of mass transit before they start becoming attractive replacements for mass transit? How many riders could the financially fraught MBTA lose before the law starts to have an impact across the system as a whole? Well, with us now in the studio is Richard Domino. He's president and CEO of A Better City, a business-backed nonprofit that advocates for transportation. He's also co-chair of the Mayor's Mobility Plan Advisory Committee for Boston 2030. Rick Domino, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay, great. So first of all, give us your first reaction to the $2 Uber price point in Greater Boston.
So my perspective is that Uber is just so clever and so capable relative to thinking about this market and how they're entering markets across the country and also internationally. Both the technology and their relationship to their customers and their now new pricing strategies are giving urban centers and giving people in those urban centers more choice. And I think in terms of the future of cities, choice and mobility is actually a good thing. And Uber is actually picking up on that and making ultimately, the hope is with Uber becoming more accessible, maybe less ownership of automobiles, mm-hmm. maybe less longer distance trips.
Right. So this is particularly important in Greater Boston. And I mean, I know I was sort of tweeting about this last week, and a lot of people tweeted back to me and said, hey, Uber's price point is not sustainable. They're not going to keep it at that price for $2 for long. It'll inch up and up and up. And my point is that agreed. It's not going to be $2 a ride forever. But the point is that Uber has the power to change or is trying to change people's behaviors. Now, how much of a hit, how many riders can the MBTA lose before it does have an impact on mass transit?
Well, that's where I actually think Uber is just a piece of the puzzle and not necessarily something that will replace or substitute the need for mass transit, especially for dense urbanized areas in the United States. The growth rate here in Boston is significant. We just did an analysis of our future, and the good news is that Boston, the urban core, the metropolitan region is growing at significant rates in terms of population, job growth, economic output. That job growth and economic output, for example, we did a single line analysis of just let's take how many vehicle trips are being made today and how many they could be if we don't push some of those trips. 80,000 vehicles could be on the road. So the point is that Uber is part of the puzzle. There is no way that we can substitute kind of what a rapid transit line could do or what a bus or surface transportation route could do by a single passenger, even if you're doing carpooling. Carpooling, by the way, has gone down in Massachusetts. So if Uber can actually bring it back up, it's an important part of our transportation system.
Okay, so not a substitute. I completely agree. But, I mean, the finances of the MBTA are already so terrible. I mean, there's a report in the Globe today about, once again, possibly privatizing repair, maintenance, and even bus drivers themselves that say, just say, theoretically, what if 5%, 10% of riders make a permanent switch to an Uber-type system? I mean, wouldn't that damage the T as a whole overall?
There could be that type of market influence. I just don't see it because right now we're carrying 1.3 million people on the T, and the growth rate relative to future demand relative to – let's just take the South Boston waterfront just as a quick example, okay? We just did an analysis. 17 million square feet of development still wants to happen in that area. 63% more trips relative to – 67% of those trips want to be on transit.
Yeah.
That means we're going to have to do much more relative to the Silver Line because it's at 128% capacity. That's a transit solution. That's not an Uber solution.
Okay, so Rick, hold on here for just a second. I want to come back to this in just a moment because the future, I'm obsessed about the future here. But I do want to actually turn to another city for a moment and what they're doing with Uber. So let's bring in Frank Martz. He's the city manager of Altamont Springs, Florida. And the city of Altamont Springs, home to some 44,000 people just outside of Orlando, they recently partnered with Uber to subsidize rides in their city. Mr. Martz, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, briefly, why'd you partner with Uber over, say, you know, building out bus infrastructure for Altamont Springs?
Well, in the late 90s, the city created a pilot project that was very similar to Uber. It was a demand response public transportation system. And working with our local transit company here in Orlando, who was responsible for bringing that online as the regional transportation agency, and they just failed to do it. And we still had the problem of how to attract people. And it has always been our viewpoint that convenience is going to drive the utilization of transit, you know, especially in suburban areas. I've been to Boston many times. Congestion management is an issue. We don't have that kind of congestion here.
Right.
So it has to be convenient. And when our concept was not handled appropriately by our local transit group, I got on the phone and called Uber because they are doing it. They brought that to the market. They're very competitive, and they were interested. They'd never done a citywide congestion management pilot. Ours was the first in the world.
And so how is the program working so far? I mean, are lots of people using it?
Yeah, it's been a very successful launch. Our utilization is up tenfold since we began in March, and which is anything that goes up by a multiple of 10 is really, really important. I was listening to your other segment. It really is about educating people and trying to entice them to try something different. And Boston, you know, has this condition much more so than we do here in Orlando, but in Altamont Springs particularly. But you can take a large number of people off of the road and put them in an alternative form of transportation, and the lane miles will still get filled up by other people who are trying to get on those roads. So making a shift, as much as anything, is about a lifestyle, you know, a change in lifestyle, and an effort to tap into a new generation of employees.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Frank Martz, city manager for Altamont Springs, Florida, thank you so much for joining us and giving us a brief view into what's going on there. Much appreciated.
Sure thing.
Let me turn back to Rick Domino, president and CEO of A Better City. Rick, you know I can talk until I'm blue in the face about transportation and transit. We've only got about a minute and a half left here. And I wanted to reflect to you something that Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack told WBUR earlier this year. She was asked, like, what's the most important innovation in transit and transportation, recent innovation? And she said, hands down, the most important one in the last decade, the smartphone. I think, and she's absolutely on to something. But my retort to that then is, what can we do? What do we need to do to further push the MBTA to capitalize on the flexibility, the customization, the price drops that smartphone technology can offer? We're seeing that with Uber, Bridge, et cetera. But the T needs to get further on board.
We are totally with you. And in we, I actually mean Secretary Pollack as well. We are working with the MBTA on a single medium payment, which may in fact lead to having us use our smartphone, touch the turnstile, and have our ability to get into the T, pay for parking, have a single payments system that allows you to cross all forms of our transportation system and have that be the way in which we pay. That
what
means,
about even more aggressively, like making bus routes dynamic?
I think that's part of the thinking as well. Plus, we can change the pricing structure based on time of day. We can change the pricing structure regarding some of the equity challenges that we might be facing here in Greater Boston as well. So they just put out an RFQ that we helped them create to see if we can move forward with this new technology and see if we can do some more dynamic work here in Boston.
So
in the transit system.
I want to talk with you more about that at another time before the clock comes crashing down on us. We will come back to this because absolutely fascinating. Richard Dimino, President and CEO of A Better City, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me again.
Send us a tweet at Radio Boston about what you think about smartphones and the future of the MBTA and Uber's $2 a ride program. What do you think? We're at Radio Boston. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Moby began his musical career in earnest, in poverty, and in an abandoned factory 1 mile south of the Stamford, Connecticut train station. But he heard music everywhere. In the gunshots after sundown, the gospel pumping out of the Jamaican church across the street, from the passing cars playing Public Enemy at window-rattling levels, and from the roosters kept in backyards near the industrial wasteland where he lived. Years later, Moby's music was everywhere. His 1999 mega-hit album, Play, went platinum in more than 20 countries, and he was called one of the most important electronic dance music artists of all time.
I've seen so much in so many places, so many heartaches, so many faces, so many dirty things, you couldn't even believe I would stand in line for this.
The story of how he got there, through drug and alcohol addiction and wrestling with doubts about his deeply felt Christianity and his relationship with God, that is the story Moby tells in his new memoir, Porcelain.
Oh, baby. Oh, baby. Then it fell apart. It fell apart.
Moby came into our studios to talk about his book and his early life, but something interesting happened before we started talking. I asked him which one of his tracks he thought would best get the conversation going, and he surprised us. He said, none of them. Instead, he wanted to start with something else, the 1975 country and pop novelty song Convoy by C.W. McCall.
So, this was the first 7-inch single I ever bought. In 1974 or 1975, I was living in Stratford, Connecticut, and my friend Ron Little found a $5 bill. And it was honestly the most exciting thing that had ever happened in either one of our lives. Like, we'd never even seen $5. And he gave me a dollar. And with that dollar, I bought the 7-inch of Convoy by C.W. McCall, which was this weird country western song about CB radios.
It was the dark of the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth pulling logs. Cab over Pete with a reefer on and a Jimmy hauling hogs. We is heading for Bear on I-10 about a mile out of Shaky Town. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck and I'm about to put the hammer down.
I listened to it 40 times in a row. Like, I kept picking up the needle and putting it down, picking up the needle and putting it down, like compulsively, obsessively listening to this song.
We got a great big convoy rocking through the night. Yeah, we got a great big convoy. Ain't you beautiful sight?
Why were you so compulsive about that song? What were you hearing in it?
Every time I heard music when I was growing up, let's say from like age 2 until age 10, I just couldn't believe that something that existed in the immaterial realm would transform the environment in which it was being heard and which would completely affect me emotionally. Like, it just seemed like this utterly baffling alchemical magic.
How important was it to you as that young boy in Connecticut who, you know, rarely if ever had seen $5 to have music allow that transformation outside of your what your reality was?
It was, for me, profoundly important because I hated my reality. I grew up very poor in a very affluent town, Darien, Connecticut, and I was on food stamps and welfare till I was 18. And when I was growing up, I loved anything that took me out of that.
You know, in the book Porcelain, you write very honestly and touchingly about that time growing up. I mean, the book opens with a scene of you and your mom at a laundromat, and at times neighbors paid her mm-hmm. to do their laundry. And you sort of took shelter in the car because it was raining and it was depressing, and you just needed to escape that moment, and how you were listening to the radio and just jumping between channels because no music was off limits. I mean, were you that? There's a musical way in which you, it seemed to me as if you were hearing the world. I mean, is that an accurate interpretation?
I think it's almost, not to sound too grad student-y, but like a hypersomatic sensitivity. If your formative years happen in a safe, predictable environment, you don't need to develop hypersensitivity. You trust that the world and your family has your back. But I grew up in a very unstable environment. And so as a result, I think some deep atavistic part of my brain developed a hypersensitivity towards everything, towards light, towards furniture, towards temperature, towards everything.
Well, I'm going to just want to move forward in time a little bit, away from your formative years in Connecticut to 1995 and the album Everything Is Wrong, because there's a particular track that you write about how you wrote it so beautifully in Porcelain, the memoir, and that track is God Moving Over the Face of the Waters. So let's listen.
I had a long period as a very serious Christian, and now just as a way of sort of being an apologist for my own weird faith. Like, I am a Taoist, quantum mechanics loving, Sufi, aspiring Jew, Hindu, whatever. I'm an everything. I don't feel the need to treat spirituality like a sports team.
Now, in the book, you write about how when you were writing this, composing this piece of music, that, I mean, it brought you to tears.
Mm-hmm. So there's some language in the beginning of the Bible, and they said, you know, the earth was without form and void, and God moved over the face of the waters. So when I was writing this piece of music, I had this vision of the Spirit of God, whoever, whatever that might be, moving over the earth and just seeing this tabula rasa, this blank slate of a planet, but with foresight and prescience and omniscience, seeing what was going to happen. All of the suffering, but all of the joy.
There's a sort of continuing subcurrent in the book that I, at least it felt like to me, that you'd always been from a young age sort of either attracted to or drawn to this sort of monastic sensibility, because I was thinking about how you were living in an abandoned warehouse for a time in Connecticut. And actually, I mean, you write about it very lovingly, that you adored living there.
I loved my abandoned warehouse.
In a 100-square-foot little patch of the warehouse.
Yeah, I didn't have a bathroom. I didn't have running water. And I was making around $3,000 a year. But I loved my little corner of the abandoned warehouse. Like, I was in this factory. I had a community of friends. I was making music with my Casio keyboard and my cheap old cassette recorder. And I was very happy. I just didn't know it at the time.
Yeah.
You know, because I assumed, oh, I'll be happy when I move to New York. I'll be happy when I get a record deal. I'll be happy when I have commercial success. And all those things are fine, but none of them actually deliver happiness. Mm-hmm. Like, because rich people are miserable. You know, I had this experience a few years ago. I was at a billionaire's birthday party in New York, and he had rented the Hammerstein Ballroom, which holds about 4,000 people, and he only had 100 people there, which was weird, 100 people in a venue that held 4,000. And he hired Earth, Wind & Fire to play, and Michael Bloomberg was there, and Trump was there, and all the New York billionaires were there. I got invited. I don't even know how I got invited. And Earth, Wind & Fire were playing, and Trump was dancing, Bloomberg was dancing, but they were joyless, clearly like just uptight and joyless. And I looked over at the kitchen staff who were dancing and having the time of their lives. Huh. And I simply thought, like, how have we all gotten this so wrong that everyone aspires to be the billionaire, but the billionaires are miserable?
Well, I'm speaking with Moby. His new memoir is called Porcelain, and it chronicles his life most detailed way through the 90s, just before the release of his mega hit, Play. We've got a track here that I think you released not long after moving to New York. It's called Rock the House, that you recorded under the pseudonym Brainstorm. Do I have that right in terms of the date?
I think that sounds right.
Okay, so let's listen. Rock the house, rock the house. Rock the house, rock the house. So tell us a little bit about your early days in New York.
So in the mid-80s, I started getting more and more exposed to dance music and black music and Latino music. And I found myself as a straight white guy from Connecticut DJing and hanging out in predominantly African-American Latino gay clubs and falling in love with that culture and feeling so honored to be allowed into that world. And it was just a wonderful time because the dance culture then was really, and I kind of hate to use this word, but it was truly underground, meaning there were mores and sounds and modes of dress and everything that only existed in this little world in Lower Manhattan.
Yeah.
You know, you'd have huge hit records that only were huge hit records in like a 10-block radius. Mm.
Did you ever feel, though, at times that the places where your music was allowed to flower and grow the way it did, were those places and what was happening in them were in conflict with your Christianity? Because you were getting DJ jobs off your other DJ jobs. You were getting hooked up with other people, and you got hired to work in what was basically like a sex loft.
Yeah.
And there are mattresses everywhere, and people are having sex. I mean, did you ever feel conflicted that these were the places that your music was allowed to flourish?
You know, I think that somehow at that time, I was really good at compartmentalizing. You know, so by day, I was this serious Christian, but then at night, I would DJ anywhere. And it didn't seem like a conflict to me. I can see why it would have seemed like a conflict to other people, but I think I had some sort of subjective, innate idea that ethics only apply to actions that potentially hurt other things or other people. You know, so like walking into a sex club, if it's all volitional, if people are there, you know, no one's there being coerced to do anything, but a bunch of like sad Department of Motor Vehicle employees having naked sex on like soiled mattresses, like that just seemed depressing, not necessarily unethical.
We should probably get some more music back into this conversation here. So let's jump to 1991, I believe. And this is, again, a, kind of a track from your earlier days in New York. This is Go, Woodtick Mix, that you made, I believe, after watching an episode of Twin Peaks. So let's listen.
This song, Go, to put it in perspective, I'd had a single before Go came out called Mobility, and I think we sold 2,000 copies of Mobility, which to me was a huge success. Then Go came out, and it became a top 10 record in Europe. And I was on Top of the Pops with New Order and Phil Collins, and I remember flying to England and looking at a newspaper where they had a singles chart, and my little song that I'd recorded in my bedroom, essentially, was in between Phil Collins and Michael Jackson. And I just thought, what in the world has happened here? Like, this is not how it's supposed to be. I'm supposed to be a weird, obscure musician from New England who no one pays attention to. Like, that's the natural order of things. Like, it was almost like a disturbance in the force that led me to have anything even resembling a career.
Hmm. Well, since we are here in Boston, I do want to talk a little bit about Mission of Burma because you covered one of their great songs. And here's the Mission of Burma version of their own song that you covered. Here it is.
Fast forward 15 years. It's 1996. I'm known as like a techno icon, and I say that in air quotes. The entire world is ready for the techno musicians to make their platinum records, and the Prodigy come out and they make their platinum record, and Fatboy Slim makes his platinum techno record, and the Chemical Brothers make their platinum techno record, and I make a dark, difficult, noisy punk rock record called Animal Rights that sells nothing and is pretty much universally reviled. But I did a cover of the Mission of Burma song. That's when I reached for my revolver. That's when I reached for my revolver. That's when it all gets blown away. Because there was such a desperate emotional resignation and beauty to that song. One of the goals of art is to sort of say, this is my experience of being, you know, at times joyful, at times sad, but always vulnerable in this weird human form.
I wanted to close with a question that links us back to where we started. Your story about being a young 8 and 9-year-old boy in Connecticut, because you actually, you kind of end with that thought in the book. You talk about how an ex-girlfriend of yours had told you that before the two of you broke up, she said to you that you were like a scared, beaten dog who lived under a porch, and that you agreed that you wanted to finally move out from under the porch and live in the daylight but couldn't, and that if you came out from under the porch and ran around in the light, you worried that, quote, I would be seen for who I really was, the inadequate 8-year-old boy with food stamps in his pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been able to fully come out into the light?
Oh, absolutely not. I think that on an almost like archetypal level, like who you are during your formative years, to some extent you are for your entire life. I have this weird, I call it the rolled up carpet theory of personality. Like, you've bought rolled up carpets before, right?
Yeah.
So you take it home, you put it on the floor, and it just wants to stay as a rolled up carpet. Because for a long time, that's all it's been, a rolled up carpet in a warehouse somewhere. And it made a lot of sense for it to stay as a rolled up carpet. It takes a lot of effort to turn it into a regular carpet lying flat on the floor. Like, weeks of like putting books and weights on the corners to like force it to go flat. And so undoing these sort of ingrained innate personal archetypes from our developmental years, from the formative years, takes a lot of effort. But to an extent, we are always the rolled up carpet in the warehouse, you know. So part of it's like changing what you can and accepting the rest.
Ooh, Lord, trouble so hard.
Well, the new memoir is called Porcelain. It's Moby's story of his own life from a young boy to his early years in New York City, all the way up to what inspired the release of Play. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing the story with us and for talking with me. This has been an absolute pleasure. And in the spirit of what you talked about, it's made me very happy.
Oh, well, thanks. Thank you very much.
And that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.